It's an oral history interview on the 11th of July, 2014, for the Westminster School Archives with Alex Bishop.
And Stephen Spur, the outgoing headmaster.
And this is the second instalment of two. So, headmaster, of course, in your role, you see all areas of the Westminster School community. So we've talked about the pupils and the common room and the governors for briefly. But perhaps you wanted to comment on what your relation with the parents has been, which obviously plays quite an important role in the life of any teacher, but a headmaster especially. And then also your relations with the old Westminsters and the Elizabethan Club, which I know is very important.
Well, thank you very much, Alex, because those are two groups, if you like, of what I call the Westminster community, with which I have worked with great pleasure, and whom I think are terribly important for sustaining the school. If I might take the parents first, and a line from, I think, one of the early writings of Hillary Clinton, which was, "It takes a village to raise a child." Not that I agree with Hillary about absolutely everything, but I do agree with that. The world is a complex place, and we need all our resources to raise the next generation of pupils, of citizens. And I happen to be one of those headmasters who believes, whatever people think, that the next generation is the nation's treasure. And so it is behoven on adults to work together. And I have therefore worked closely with parents. Sometimes I've referred to this as a triangle, with pupils at one angle, parents at another, and school at the third. We would like in our mind's eye to see that perhaps as an equilateral triangle. Sometimes it turns into isosceles triangle, with parents and school close down near the bottom and the pupils racing off at the top. But it's a very, very important triangle, however it changes shape. And my view is that while, of course, we are working together with parents to produce independent young men and women, actually, it's all about interdependence at the end of the day. That is what makes a family, a school, a society strong. And that's, as it were, the main reason why I try to work together with all those, with those two groups, with the parents and the pupils. Moving on to the old Westminsters, you could say it's a bit of a conveyor belt, what I run here. We're constantly renewing the old Westminsters. And when I came, we had one person working in what we now call the development office. Mm. And that number has increased because I have wanted to track down old Westminsters and build up a database to be in touch with them on a much more regular basis, to make them feel part of their former school. I want them to feel proud of it. I want them to get behind it. And each pupil who leaves, I want him or her to feel that it's still a place they want to come back to quite early on, rather than to wait until they're 40s, 50s or my age before they turn their mind back to the school. So I've worked very hard at that, and I'm very pleased with how that's gone. And in fact, one of the things I did very early on was to consult old Westminsters across the board of all ages and to find out what they thought about their school. As I did a parental survey too, and it was very revealing. And so both parents and old Westminster have been very important to my vision of the school.
I'm just on that note, I'm just slightly intrigued by the fact that there are a couple of old Westminsters in the common room, of course. Do you think that they offer a different style of teaching or a different outlook on the school to certainly the newer faces in the common room, and then also the old Westminster's point of view on the school?
Yes, I think that's very important. I myself, unlike quite a lot of headmasters, actually like to get old Westminsters back in the common room. Mm. There are quite a lot of my colleagues in other schools who think that's the last thing they want.
Right, yeah.
But I've seen that as something I've really enjoyed. And as it happens, two or three of the old Westminsters who are in the common room have either gone on to greater things and senior leadership positions elsewhere or retired. But I have seen it as a great strength.
Mm.
They are part of that tradition. And if they can come back and teach, they can help me to show to their peers of their age group that Westminster is still a living place and a place worth supporting.
Yes, absolutely. Brilliant. So, moving on to a different subject then. Over the past 9 years, Westminster's position internationally has changed a lot, of course, certainly from looking outwards from within. How would you say Westminster's perception internationally has changed as a global leader in education? And also, what sorts of things have you done to increase Westminster's international role and outlook?
Well, I think from implicit in our earlier discussion, was my view that Westminster needed to look outward more.
Yes.
First nationally, and then internationally. There's no doubt that this century is going to be a very international one.
Yes.
So I take it on myself the rather... Well, I gave a talk in Singapore 18 months ago under the rather presumptuous title of Today's Pupils, Tomorrow's Global Citizens.
Mm.
And I believe that I need to educate pupils who have the qualifications, the outlook, the character, the resilience, the interest, to feel at home and confident wherever they go to work or live or study around the world.
Mm.
And they need to be aware of global issues. They need to be aware of international political issues as well. And so that is something I have tried to do. In terms of Westminster's reputation worldwide, the fortuitous and hard-won reputation we have by consistently being ranked first in the Financial Times league tables, which, remember, is the only comprehensive league tables, because all schools have to be in it, because the Financial Times obtains its data from government records some 6 months after the public examinations of the previous year. And that those league tables are a combination of three things: GCSEs, A-levels, and in our case also pre-Us, and also admission to the top universities worldwide.
Mm.
The fact that Westminster has come first in those Financial Times league tables for 6 years running, and the Financial Times is a worldwide newspaper, Westminster has, as it were, shot to stardom.
Right.
And you know, one finds people from all over the world coming and asking, how is it that a school is able consistently to stay right at the top? Not just get to the top, but also stay consistently. So that has helped. Fortuitously, we haven't rushed after league table positions at all here, because we believe in the intellectual intrinsic pursuit, but that has been fortuitous. What I've also tried to do is to make links with top schools around the world.
Mm.
We have reshaped our traditional links with European schools through exchanges,
yes.
But we have also recently started an exchange with China's top academic school, with a very, very good school we've just started with in Japan, and also with a top academic school in New York.
Yes.
If we can find out how the best pupils in the best schools worldwide are being educated, that allows me to feel confident that I am educating you at that level, or even surpassing those expectations. And the other thing we've made a conscious policy of is being in touch with top universities around the world to know what their expectations are of the best pupils, because they're all looking for the best qualified pupils worldwide. So that seemed another way of doing it too. We've also entered international competitions. I mean, it is a concern for me that Westminster pupils who are selected for their country in a wide range of subjects to compete in international Olympiads they might then come out first in the UK, but they're 21st worldwide. So what more do I have to do? So right, I'm not complacent.
Yes.
But Westminster cannot just bask in national glory. It needs to think more globally.
Yes. So Westminster is, of course, very much a London-based boarding school. But, of course, we do have some international borders. And lots of schools take very differing views on this. So what would you say the international borders offer to boarding life, and what in return do you think they get out of it, which is special about Westminster?
Well, I'm very glad you put that way round, because most boarding schools, I suppose, would think in terms of what they are giving to those international boarders.
Mm.
When you mention London-based, I think that's a very important point, and I might just pick up quickly on that. London is now one of the world's premier international cities.
Absolutely.
And the ambitious inward investment into London means also that the educational standards within London are being driven upwards. And that is also one way that Westminster is able, therefore, to maintain its position and also look worldwide. Westminster, unlike many boarding schools, is not actually reliant economically on the importation of overseas pupils.
Right.
There are many of the very top boarding schools that if the market were to drop out of the Asia-Pacific region, for example, the schools would be in serious financial condition. I myself have always resisted that. So something like 170 of the 175 pupils, of the 185 pupils who board at the school, 170 come from within the M25.
Right,
The other 15, we are very fortunate to be able to choose from quite around the world. And we have taken the view recently that those pupils, while coming to... they've chosen Westminster because they want what they see as the best education available in the world. But that we want to understand from them, because they are top students, their cultural backgrounds, their interests, their abilities, and to learn from them as part of our, if you like, ability to produce pupils who have that global outlook. So we've spent quite a lot of time recently looking at that, and as it happens, the excellent head of Mandarin, which is the new subject we brought into the core curriculum now, who has a wide international experience, is a tutor for those pupils, but is there in order to A, to integrate them, but to show others what we can learn from them too.
So, looking back at the interview that we conducted yesterday and everything that we've said this afternoon as well, what would you say you leave behind at the school in terms of the change in the ethos which you talked about so eloquently yesterday? What was left?
Well, I'm glad that you, Alex, are talking about the ethos at the end of our interview. Because there are so many headmasters that when asked about, you know, what is their development plan, and they say things like, I want to build a swimming pool. I think they're getting the wrong end of the stick. The swimming pool may be a good thing to do, but it needs to grow out of the ethos. As it happens, I haven't built a swimming pool. Luckily, we have a swimming pool just on the other side of Vincent Square, Queen Mother Centre, which we hire, and someone else takes care of the expense and the maintenance, so that's no problem. But getting back to that ethos, well, there's a... I don't know whether you've read The Leopard by Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa.
I haven't.
You haven't? Well, may I suggest that I know you've got a very, very busy holiday ahead of you, but you may like to do so. It's written in an exquisite Italian, the Gatto Pardo, but the English translation available through Collins is very good. That was a seminal book which was published posthumously in 1958, I think. It's one of my favourite books. And it talks about how southern Italian culture has changed, particularly in Sicily. And one of the main characters says something along the lines, "Se vogliono che tutto rimanga com'è, bisogna che tutto cambi." In other words, if we want things to stay as they are, things will have to change. Do remember that for the future. You cannot remain static. You have to be changing if you want to stay as you are. If you want to stay at the top of something, you have to be changing. But most importantly, if you want the ethos to remain strong, and the ethos for me of a school is everything. So I'm very pleased you've used this word at the end of our conversation. Then you have got to have gone back and understood what that ethos is. And within it, you've got to allow things to change. You've got to have the courage to bring forward change. The dean, in his send-off speech to me, a poor man, he's found himself having to make several of them. There was a long one when the governors and the fellows got together. And he said that the big, I'm not quite sure whether he used the word trick, but the success of the headmaster has been to transform Westminster without anyone noticing that it has changed. That is because together we've gone back to rediscover that ethos. We've gone back right far to the Benedictine tradition. One of the, I don't know whether you've ever read The Rule of St. Benedict.
I haven't read it.
Well, that might be another book come to read. The Rule of St. Benedict, it's about how an abbot should run a monastery. And all headmasters should read that. Sometimes there's not much of a difference between an abbot and a headmaster. Particularly if you're like me, you feel the spiritual life is important. One of my favourite lines in that is that the Lord will often speak through the mouth of the youngest. So I have always wanted to try to give the pupils a voice. I have always made an effort to learn the name of every single pupil in the school so that I can speak to them and know them and understand them. I think I might be the last of my generation of headmasters who writes a report on every single pupil every term. I've just finished my 21,000 reports in 9 years at Westminster. So, or if you take, for example, the pastoral care, which we've tried to work on hard here, you take that Elizabethan line from the charter that I mentioned yesterday, that the youth are like young shoots. Sometimes people say, well, childhood wasn't invented in the Elizabethan period. But anyone who's talking about children as young shoots growing in the wood of our state, that shows that there's pastoral care and thinking about them. So that's terribly important as they grow up. Anyone who thinks about this school, if you look at its Elizabethan refoundation in the English Renaissance, it was a period which really valued academic intelligence, intellectual pursuits, wit, music, drama, a range of sports, not everyone having to do kind of necessarily muscular sports like rugby and everything else, a range of sports. You were at that election dinner. That is something unique about Westminster, but that takes us right back to that Elizabethan period. Take the sports centre, which Her Majesty Elizabeth II has just opened. The great thing about that sports centre is not that we're drumming one or two or just three sports, but she saw a whole range of sports going on. These are elements which I've taken right back from that ethos of Westminster. And I think that is why, if it is true that everything has been transformed but nothing has changed, it's been successful because it has linked itself into that ethos. In the Elizabethan magazine, a former senior master Rob Bevan wrote that he thought that my legacy might be that Westminster was a gentler place. Well, that's a nice thought. And I just had a very nice letter from the registrar. From the registrar, who has written that he feels when showing prospective parents and pupils around, he can honestly say their children are going to be happy here because it is a gentler place. Mm. I wouldn't want to be thought as, you know, gentler. It means we don't have any edge, we don't have any toughness. But perhaps it's a gentler, and again, I take that right back to the Elizabethan age, that, you know, the Renaissance gentleman, the person who believed in public service, the person who believed in that civic engagement, and I think that too. So, ethos, yes, I've done my best to shape that again, or reshape it for the 21st century, and let's hope my successors will continue the idea of the ethos. I would like to say at the end, simply, that I have been proud to play my part as the 38th headmaster of Westminster.
Wonderful. Excellent. I'm sure the archivist won't mind if I end on a slightly more light-hearted note. My mother suggested I ask whether you had a best and worst moment of being headmaster, just to finish.
Well, headmasters have many very, very lonely moments. Sometimes think of that 18th century caricature of a headmaster surrounded by books and other things and with his head in his hand. I think one of my most difficult moments was when I actually announced to the common room that I was going to leave. Mm. I felt I had worked very hard with the common room, we'd got on very well together and we'd created something great, and so that was a difficult moment.